Accession number 29076, Reel 1.
Nigel Rose, Reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Newcastle on Tyne, 1918. My father was, I think, works manager, I think, at the Vickers Armstrong Works at Elswick and Newcastle at the time.
And your mother?
My mother comes from a Sussex village, Curdford, and I had two elder brothers, both of whom are still alive. One is 91 and has just got married for the fourth time, and the other is 93.
What do you remember of your schooling?
What years?
What do you remember of your schooling?
Oh, I had a very sort of reasonably happy time. Prep school at Weston-super-Mare. And then I went to Felsted, which of course is not very far from here, as it happens. And I was there 32 to 35. That was really quite a happy time. But I think I was a little bit of a late developer, as I said. And I didn't reach the dizzy heights of a prefect or first 15 or anything like that. So I didn't quite make the most of it, I'm afraid.
What were your hobbies at school?
Hobbies? I don't know really that I had any particularly. I think I tried to join in as much as possible with the various societies and things that were going, but I don't remember any intense interest in one subject at all. No.
What were your employment ambitions?
Well, when I left school, they were very vague, I think, and I told my father that I would rather like to go and get interested in optical instruments. And he said, well, if you're going to do that, my boy, you'd better go to Germany. So what we'll do now you've left school is to send you out to Germany to learn the language. So I went out to stay with the family in Cologne. My eldest brother had stayed with 3 or 4 years before. 4 or 5 years before, and having got there, I found they had a daughter of the same age as I was, 17, and I felt her in a big way. I think it was the first girl I'd met, I think. And I'm not sure that didn't delay my learning the language rather a lot, you know, as I was perhaps never very academically minded. We played a lot of tennis and that sort of thing, but I think just to diverge a bit. This girl, I wrote a letter to her yesterday. We still keep in touch. That's after, I don't know, what's it now, 75 years or something, I think. No, not quite. Anyway, it was 70 years, with a gap in the year, in the war, of course. Yeah. But anyway, I stayed there for 5 months, I think, and then came back and went to the GEC in North Wembley. My father thought that part of the same sort of thing, I'd better learn a little bit about an engineering firm, and I went onto the bench of a subsidiary of GEC's called Watson's, who were building diathermy apparatus. And it looked quite modern, even in this day and age, you know, sort of X-ray stuff too, on chromium-plated columns, sort of push up and down, and a sort of floor set on casters which wheeled around, you know, with lots of wires and things poking out of it and dials and so on. And I think I was concerned with connecting up the backs of these wires and screwing up knobs and things like that. And I also spent 3 months in the machine shops on caps and lathes, which one became quite proficient at, and they were sort of winding handles and pulling levers and, you know, masses of soapy water being flushed all over the place, and an inspection chap coming round and condemning a whole lot of the sort of things you'd especially take a lot of care to form, because they were just sort of half a millimetre out or something. I've learned quite a lot there, I think. And then, am I going on too fast? Or
no.
And then I went on to London University to read engineering, and I think by then I'd rather got even more vague about what I wanted to do, and I think I lost the enthusiasm for optical instruments. And I still didn't know really what to do, and I sat for a BSc. I think I failed the first year's exams, but I managed to squeeze past the intermediate in the next year. But by then, I told my father, really, I wasn't sure what to do. So he sent me to the Institute of Industrial Psychology, and they gave me a grueling and a lot of questions and answers and scribbling on diagrams and things. And they produced a sort of 8-page report giving 3 recommendations for a career. One was actuarial work. One was, I think, accountancy, which I suppose there's some similarity there. And the third one was quantity surveying, which I'd never heard of, nor had anybody in my family, so I chose that and went into a quantity surveyor's office down in Southampton.
What year was this, sorry?
We're now in 1938, so 3 years have passed. One at GEC, 2 at university, and now we're 1938, and towards the end of it. And I went into this office and made the tea and answered the telephone and began to hold one end of the tape and things like that, and things were being measured. And in December, I decided I'd try and catch up with my brothers, who I think I felt had rather sort of shown me up to be a bit of a third son. I think I got a slight chip on my shoulder. But anyway, I thought, what I'll do, I'll join the RAFVR, and that'll show them. I feel that all I, except there was a girl down there that I wanted to impress, but one's only got vague memories of all this. So I joined up the RAFVR and went to the evening classes, and for which we were paid a shilling an hour, which is good money those days, to attend. That's what, 5p, isn't it, I think? Yes, 5p an hour.
Why did you choose the RAF?
As I say, I think because I thought that was modern and in it, something that would surprise my family and make them sit up and realise they've got admittedly a junior son, but somebody with some ideas of his own. I think that must have been in the back of my mind. Perhaps because I'd been so long in sort of making up my mind what to do. I'm so vague. Anyway, the evening classes were, engines, airframes, hygiene, all sorts of vaguely connected and disconnected things from joining a service. How to distinguish between an Air Vice Marshal and an Admiral of the Fleet, and important things like that. So that went on, and then right through the winter, and then beginning of 1939. Yes, I got a call up to prepare myself to go to Hamble, which is on the Hamble River near Southampton, to elementary and reserve flying training school to start flying in April. And I had a fortnight there and learnt to fly and did my first solo on an Avro Cadet. And then we, later in the summer, graduated after about 50 hours on those to Hartz and Hawker Hartz and Hines, wonderful airplanes. The Hawker Hartz and Hines you could recognise as being a development from First World War biplanes, and then later on you could see if in your mind's eye you took off the top wing, it was a bit like a Hurricane, the shape of the body anyway, not the engine, which was a comparatively modest, I think 600 horsepower or something, Rolls Royce engine, Kestrel, I think it's called. And so that went on for a little while, and then finally, September 3rd, we got called up from the office, and that made no difference to getting back to the office for the next 2 or 3 months, because finally I got posted to the initial training wing at Cambridge. The RAF had taken over 3 of the Cambridge colleges, Jesus, Pembroke and Clare, and I was sent to Clare. Shared a room, funnily enough, purely by coincidence, with Geoffrey Verdon Rowe, who was the son of Elliot Verdon Rowe. That might not mean anything to you, but he was the Avro aircraft, took a large part in the First World War and the Second World War, Lancasters and things like that. And had also been produced, the cadet in which I had trained too. So Geoffrey Verdon Rowe got to do quite well there. He sort of led me astray into the centre of London and how to live. Some of this is not for repetition. Anyway.
How How much awareness and anticipation did you have prior to the outbreak of war that war was coming?
Oh, quite a lot from I think the beginning of the middle of about 38. I think. Do you remember the way we went? But we must have read about Munich and and Chamberlain getting over there and sort of coming back. Sort of, you know, chaps, I've got a bit of paper here. It's all signed up by Hitler, and it's going to be peace in our time. And da da da. And the newspapers, I think, were extremely doubtful about all this. Whereas the average person in the street, which I think I cut myself to, reckoned, oh, well, you know, it could show the war is receding. And then gradually, I think one began to feel, well, no, that's not so, because more and more countries are being taken over. There was the Anschluss with Austria and moving Czechoslovakia, all sorts of different things. So one got a good warning of something building up. And then you found everybody seemed to be joining up, you know, and that's when I felt, well, you know, if the girls around here think that's the right thing to do, I must join too. I'm sorry to say this, but I think my most reckoning of one's cred was going downhill unless one joined up. It wasn't quite so much patriotism as it ought to be, but I suppose a little bit, but I think it was more, you know, one wanted to be respected for doing the right thing. So I joined up. Yeah.
Was there any sense that you did expect to then be flying in anger?
I don't think I thought very much about the future, really. I'd like to fly and learn to fly, and well, there's, you know, probably flying some aircraft or another later on, but I don't think I thought very, very closely, I'm ashamed to say, of what was coming. Yeah. And
going back to your time in Germany, what could you say about the situation there?
Oh, that's fascinating, because the family I stayed with are very anti-Nazi. They didn't like Nazis at all. And I mean, just to illustrate that, I remember when the Brian ship, you know, the stormtroopers were sort of marching along the Volksgartenstrasse outside the flat, whatever. It was a second floor flat. The girls used to go out on the balcony and shriek derision at them, and their father said, "No, stop it, you mustn't do that," because he knew that his job at the university, he lectured in Latin and Greek there, and he was told that his job was on the line if he didn't show a bit more enthusiasm for the coming regime. So he kept very quiet, but he told his family too as well. So I knew pretty well that they weren't all for the Fourth Reich, the new setup. He was very pro-Kaiser, and reckoned that we'd done the dirty on them at Versailles, and pinching Southwest Africa from them, and things like that. But it was fun, because I joined the tennis club in Cologne, and I can remember going up there one day when Fred Perry here was at Wimbledon playing, I think, Baron von Kramm. And that was great, because Perry won. Or was it Bunny Austin? I can't remember. It's too much for detail, but either Perry or Austin, and von Kramm was beaten, and I was the only Briton there, so that was a good show. But on the hill, they were all very friendly, and you know, wherever, whatever their background, all against the French and pro-British, that's the way it was. But tell me if I'm getting too garrulous. I do tend to get run off, and you must stop me if I telling you things we don't want to hear. Anyway.
Was there any sense of the coming crisis and the war when you were in Germany?
In Germany?
At least from your time.
Not in our direction, no. Nor, I think, in the Russian direction. I don't think there was any fear of it. I think they were rather proud of the fact they were building up some nice sort of... So far as the Army, Navy and Air Force were concerned, Hitler was taking charge and doing what he probably well thought was right. And I think they at least thought that was a good thing, but as I say, the family didn't like I think I remember one of the girls saying to me that Gertrude Klein, I think her name was, who was a Jewess, I think, at their school, had told them that somebody had been taken off in the night and they were worried about his future or something. There was very little talk then in, I'm talking about 35, you see, and Kristallnacht, whatever, hadn't taken place by then, and I think there was not an awful lot of sign of anti-Jewishness, and, just to continue my story, I was very keen on this girl, and I wrote her quite a bit, and she came over, not to see me, I think, but because she was quite good at English as a language. She learned it at school. She came over to be an au pair with a clergyman down in West Wittering, you know, on the coast, and she stayed there a couple of months or so, and I can remember getting into a train at Waterloo, going down to Wittering, sitting on the beach with her for 1 hour, dying to hold her hand, which I was much too shy to do that, and going back, getting a train, going back to London. Oh dear, laughter. I was absolutely cobstruck with her. I fell for her in a big way. But she never realised, it was unrequited love. Anyway, I went back to Germany in 36 and 37 for fortnights at a time, and undeniably to see more of her. But I still wasn't in the stage of holding her hand. Just shows it.
How good.
Our paths sort of parted about 38, I suppose, as things began to get rather tricky, and so there's then a sort of gap in our relations until 1946, I think. It comes after the main part that you're concerned with.
How good did your German get?
How
good did your German get over the course of the
pretty life? Rotten. Still is, I'm afraid. They talk very good English. They're both Anglophiles, she and her husband. And, but I'll tell you more about that later if you want to hear it. So, we've got to Cambridge.
Could we just come back to your training for a little bit?
Oh, yes.
What were the characteristics of the cadets?
The Avro cadets, yeah. You know, the cadets.
The Avro cadets.
Avro cadets. Well, it was very like, have you flown a Tagamoth or anything like that? Well, it's an elementary trainer, built robustly in case it got dropped from the last 10, 15 feet or something. A very good trainer, I think, indeed. Like the Tagamoth, it hasn't got a lot of oomph, but very good little plane, and to begin to fly, wonderful. And then we went to these lovely looking things, and quite good performance to the Hawker planes, Harts and Hinds. Our teachers were RAF officers, flight lieutenant was in charge of it, I think, and a flying officer, the sort of principal trainer, instructor. And Hamble was a very nice place because, you know, afterwards I could retire to the pub and have a good drink on a summer's evening. We'd go out for an hour's flying, also have a bit of duel, a bit of solo, and then go and have a drink. I mean, it was an ideal sort of life, really.
Was there a progression of stages that one would go through?
Yes, I mean, cadets for perhaps 2 or 3 months and would learn aerobatics and, first of all, simple stuff like sort of stall turns, and you would learn to spin fairly early on, and that was so that you could get yourself out of trouble if you were at a sufficient height to pull yourself out of trouble, and sort of elementary stuff, including cross country. I had run to Filton in Bristol, and then when you graduated to Hawker aircraft, you did more advanced aerobatics and you know, sort of loops and rolls and stall turns and all sorts of rather nice things. And I think I'd done in total about 83 hours when war broke out and one was called up.
Was that an average?
I would think, you know, probably average. I mean, some have done more and some have done less, but we thought we would be immediately taken to the front line. And it rather bruised our pride, I think, when we finally been sent to Cambridge. where we did Pity in the Snow and sent on route marches. And we'll pull your socks up. We'll take your, when it was ushered before the commandant, who was, I think, a group captain or a wing commander, whatever. And you know, one went into his presence and you took her hat off straight away, but it was brought up properly. And the warrant officer said, "Put your hat on, Rose." And one saw shamefaced and they put it back on again. And the warrant officer was not slow to remind us that we were now in a service, and we got to behave as though we were in a service. And none of your mollycoddled mum's little boy sort of attitude. We thought he was absolutely solid, I must say. The funny point was that when it came to leaving, we had a sort of leaving party when we got our postings, thank God. And he came along to join us and have a drink with us, and we thought he was wonderful. It is one of these sort of strange things about adolescent youth that one moment you can admire, you can think a chap's an absolute brute, and the next moment you admire him for his, what he was, a grown up of some sort. And a person who was doing his job, I suppose. And very funny that I can remember that so clearly.
How much did you have in the way of the theory of flight?
How much
in the theory, as opposed to the
theory of flight? You did the same answer, that was one of the subjects which I did think I mentioned. You know, at night school and back in Southampton. Yes, engines, navigation, airframes, and theory of flight. I'm pretty sure we had that, yes. There's some ranks of officers and so on. I think that is about the majority of the things we learnt there. I can't think where it is now, but I've got a sort of document we kept where we ticked off the things we have. If I surrender my logbook and send letters to IWM, I'll see if I can look it up. About one or two pre-war things that might be glad to have.
Could you?
Am I talking too much? Or is this going all right?
Could you describe what you remember of the cockpits of the cadets? And then the Hawker Huts and the Hinds.
Yes, I don't think I've got a photograph of them, but compared with a Spitfire or a modern fighter, they were pretty simple. There was the central standard set of instruments, which you find even today, I think, is more or less standard. There's an airspeed indicator, altimeter, there was a climb and dive indicator, a compass, and left out something important. Altimeter, airspeed indicator, climb and dive, a compass. Oh, and a gyro compass too, which showed your sort of attitude compared with the horizon, with the level horizon on the gyro compass. There's one other, but you had oil pressure gauge, I think, and there must have been a few other elementary instruments, but not very many besides those. I forget what the brake system was there, whether it was a pedal you pushed or a handle you pulled up, and there was a flap lever, of course. I think it was, you know, fairly elementary compared with the sort of aircraft one flew later, like Spitfires and Hurricanes, but compared with modern jets, still very simple, I think, indeed.
Were you also taught instrument flying? And
well, that came, yes, that was done too at this school. They had a coach who came over, you see. And the instructor was behind you, cockpit, so he could see you all right. But in the front seat, you had this hood which you pulled over, and then you were flying on these instruments, which you had to begin with. It was quite frightening. But you soon learnt what to do and how to fly on your instruments. And I don't know whether we did any actual cloud flying then or not. Real Cloud. I think we must have done little, but presumably only probably with an instructor. But it was all good training, and this was all clocked up in the book. And you also had link trainers on the ground. Have you ever come across this? It was a little sort of funny looking aircraft on bellows, and then there was an instructor with all sorts of instruments in front of him, and lots of wires going to this thing. And it depending on how you handle all the instruments and controls, all the instruments obeyed what you were doing, and the aircraft attitude obeyed it too. Elementary, what do they call the things you have now in modern aircraft, places where they teach pilots.
Simulators?
Simulators, that's the word I wanted to. Simulator. An elementary simulator, really. And we all had to go through a number of hours of that. Yes. Do you have a dislike of cats? I ask you that because there's one there which she does like. Come in. Do you know?
Okay. Yes. Is there anything else to tell you about that? I think really we've got, unless you have another question to ask about the training period, I think we've got to Cambridge, I think it was. And we've finished at Cambridge too, is that
much,
right?
How much were you taught about what to do in the event of emergency? Engine fires or having to bail out?
Oh, that. Well, yes, you had quite a bit of, if supposing it was an engine failure or something, you were taught how to prepare yourself for forced landing. So the instructor used to ask you to select what you thought was a good field, and the first time when you found that it was a ploughed field with a ditch in the middle of it, he took you round and said, now try again. You'd look for a sort of nice meadow or something like that. And down in Southampton there was a nudist camp, I seem to remember, just off the Southampton Water, near the Hamble River where it turns in. There was a nudist camp there, and that was a favourite spot to try forced landings. You know. I don't think we actually touched down. I think we used to come in and almost touch down, or possibly just let the wheels run for a little while and then we'd take off again. But yes, we did. But for other bailing out, well, they merely told you, you know, in different circumstances, you might have to climb up to a suitable height and pull the pin, turn the thing upside down, and you know, pull your parachute thing. I'm not sure we were taught that, actually. I suppose we... I don't remember ever simulating it. You couldn't simulate it too closely.
How would one open the canopy in the event of a...
Well, the Avro Cadet was an open aircraft, didn't have a canopy. And nor did the Hart and Hind, I think. I don't think that had a canopy, no. No, I think until we flew Harvard's, which is a later phase we're coming to in a moment, I don't think it was a canopy. Yeah. So it was a fairly drafty situation, elementary flying.
What would you wear?
I learned to fly in sort of spring, and I suppose probably in a jersey and a jacket or something, and the summer, shut up, you'll put out in a moment. And later on, of course, you equipped yourself a little better, but with a canopy, unless you went over, say, 20,000 feet, you could probably... certainly in summertime, 20,000, you'd be all right with a jersey, probably. Spitfires didn't have heaters, unfortunately, in those days. Curiously enough, the Harvard did. The Americans, of course, were way ahead of us in these things. But we'll come on to that in a moment. Yeah.
Nigel Rose, Reel 2. How long were you at Cambridge for?
Cambridge for 3 months, and as I say, I didn't say, I think we did, yes I did, route marches and PT in the snow. It was a very hard winter, that winter of 39, and it quite toughened us up, I think, if we were a bit sort of mollycoddled civilians, it toughened us up fairly quickly, I think, and I can remember going out and having some baked beans in Cambridge one night, and I must have had a
contaminated thing. I was terribly ill during the night, and in the morning I could scarcely stagger along. But it was so important to be doing everything that everybody else was doing. Otherwise, you might get a black mark for, you know, failing to turn up for a route march or something. And I was staggering around, just about able to sort of get round the course, whatever it was, a couple of miles or something. Oh, so I had 2 or 3 days of absolute agony. And then I only one bounce at that sort of age. I was, what, 19, 20? I was 20, I think.